Well, we're returning to the book of Daniel this morning, specifically to chapter 8. Another chapter, another dream. Another dream about kingdoms and empires coming and going and rising and falling. But what about your dreams? Can you remember what you dreamt about? Are you the sort of person that can remember your dreams? Usually I can't. Though very occasionally a dream might wake me up. Usually not a very pleasant dream when that happens. Or maybe a dream will stick in my mind for a little while afterwards, but then go away somewhere. And that would be the extent that a dream would have on me. That would be the extent of the effect. But as we look at Daniel's dreams, it's quite clear that they really shake him up. You might recall from chapter 7, which we studied together 2-3 weeks ago, Daniel said his face turned pale because the dream so deeply troubled him. And here at the end of chapter 8, he says this dream made him feel so tired and feeling sick that he had to go and have a lie down for a few days. Now Daniel, of course, is one of the many exiled Jews living in Babylon when he has these two dreams. And Belshazzar is the king of Babylon at this time. In fact, the first dream, chapter 7, happens during the first year of Belshazzar's reign. So that's 553 BC. And the dream that's here in chapter 8 happens 2 years later. So that's 551 BC, in case your mathematics isn't so great. And the reason I'm mentioning these dates is so that you might understand Daniel had these dreams 12 years before or in advance of Belshazzar being overthrown by Darius the Mede. Or in other words, 12 years before the Babylonians lost their position as the world's superpower to the Medes and the Persians. And it's also helpful to understand that chronologically, chapters 7 and 8 come before chapters 5 and 6. Now, given how these kind of dreams affected Daniel, it's probably a good thing he doesn't have them too often. In chapter 7, the scary hybrid mutated kind of beast he saw was the stuff of nightmares, wasn't it? It was probably the kind of stuff that would wake me up. And as we learned, these beasts represented the kingdoms or empires that would rise in the future, starting with the Babylonians, who would then be followed by the Medes and the Persians, the Greeks, and then the Romans. But in chapter 7, there wasn't much detail about any of those empires. There was no start and end dates. There was no naming of names. It was more of a helicopter-type view of what was to come. And the focus really was on the Antichrist that is to come. But here in chapter 8, this dream is about two of those kingdoms. It's like we're zooming in or going down the helicopter to have a closer look at two of these kingdoms. And they're represented by animals that are more normal and recognisable to us, probably things that would not wake you up in the middle of the night if you're dreaming about them. They're a bit like what we sometimes see in political cartoons like those ones there that I've put up on the screen, where animals are used to depict countries. And the characteristics of the animal are intended to communicate something about the country. So in these cartoons, which revolve around the arm wrestling that's going on around the Korean Peninsula, or North Korea in particular, between the Russians and the Chinese and the Americans. So Russia's portrayed as a bear, China's portrayed as a panda, and America's an eagle. If we were in that picture, I imagine there'd be something like a boxing kangaroo there, and if the British were represented there, there'd be a British bulldog. So that's the kind of thing that we've got here in chapter 8. And just to make it easier, Daniel gets some help, which makes it very helpful for us. Daniel gets some help from the angel Gabriel, who explains what everything stands for in his dream, and we'll come to that. But let's start at the beginning. So in verse 2, it tells us that in this dream, Daniel finds himself in the city of Susa. And for us, in our day and age, that would be found in the southwestern part of Iran. For Daniel, Susa is the capital of Persia. In fact, it was the winter playground, or palaces, if you like, of the Persian kings. But also for Daniel at the moment, it's not too significant. They haven't risen, the Persians and the Medes haven't risen to anything of significance at this point. Although the word is kind of out on the street that Persia is a kingdom that's on the rise. And moreover, the newly established relationship between the Medes and the Persians means that, looking forward, they're probably going to be a big player on the international stage. So that's where Daniel's been transported to in his dream, to Susa. And in verse 3, he says that he sees a ram. It's got two horns, one is longer than the other. And as he watches, he sees this ram charging west and north and south and sees that because of the power of this animal, there was nothing that could stand against it. He did as he pleased and he became great. So that's the ram. What's the ram? Well, if you look down at verse 20, Gabriel tells Daniel that this two-horned ram represents the kings of Media and Persia. As I said, they're not a great force at the moment, at this point in time, but before long they're going to take the world by storm. Nothing will stand in their way when their time comes, including the Babylonians, which is a sidebar note and significantly, I think, are nowhere to be seen in Daniel's dream. Then after some time, Daniel sees another animal appear. So back up to verse 5, it's a goat. And this goat has one prominent horn. And he comes across from the west at such a speed, it's like his feet hasn't touched the ground. And when he arrives in verse 7, the goat crashes into the ram and attacks him. The ram's horns are shattered, and he's trampled into the ground by this goat. The ram is powerless and helpless against the might of this goat. So what's this goat? Well, flip down to verse 21. Gabriel tells Daniel this goat represents Greece. So the mighty kingdom of the Medes and the Persians have conquered the Babylonians, and then in turn the Greeks will crush the Medes and the Persians. Then in verse 8 it says this. The goat became very great, but at the height of his power his large horn was broken off. And history is helpful to us here as we have the advantage of retrospect and being able to look back and take advantage of all the work that scholars have done. And so history helps us understand what it's talking about here, what this means. Because you see, the large horn was Alexander the Great, the king of Greece. And what Alexander is famous for, in very quick time, he conquered the entire known world. He went from west to east and took everything in his path, against often amazing odds, with just a handful of his own soldiers, against swarms of opposition soldiers. He won battles that ordinarily he perhaps should not have won. This lasted for 10 years. It was an amazing 10 years. Nothing like it has been done since. But in 10 years, in that amazing 10-year period, he conquered every nation from Greece right across to India. But then he died suddenly at the age of 33. He burned intensely, but it was quick. He died in 323 BC, and that's the horn being broken off in verse 8. But then the dream continues in the second part of verse 8. It says, in its place, so in Alexander's place, four prominent horns grew up towards the four winds of heaven. You see, here was the problem. Because Alexander had died so young, he didn't have any heirs to take the mantle of his kingdom. He had nobody to hand over to. So on his deathbed, he divided his kingdom among his generals. And eventually four successors assumed control over what had become the Greek kingdom. Now, it took, from what I understand of history, about 22 years of argy-bargy between these generals and their hanger-onerous to actually settle down on who were going to be the four. But it did happen, and so there was a bloke called Cassander, who in his division ended up taking Macedonia. There was a guy called Lysimachus, who got Asia Minor, so that's places like Turkey. Ptolemy got Egypt down south, And Seleucus got the Middle East, notably Syria, but it also included, and this is particularly important, Israel. So Alexander took over the world, he died, his estate was carved up into four pieces, and those four kingdoms, those four horns that grew up after the big one was broken off, lasted until Rome rose to power, and that was around 180 BC. But Daniel's attention in this dream is actually drawn by something else. Have a look at verse 9. Out of one of them, so this is referring to the four horns or the four generals that took over Alexander's estate, out of one of them came another horn which started small but grew in power to the south and to the east and towards the beautiful land. You might be thinking, well, good, I'm starting to get to grips with this now because I remember 3 weeks ago we were talking about the little horn in chapter 7. Unfortunately, the little horn in chapter 7 is not the little horn of chapter 8. They're different. The little horn of chapter 8 is really a type of the ultimate little horn being the Antichrist that's talked about in chapter 7. Now, the beautiful land. When he talks about the little horn making his way towards the beautiful land, he's talking about the beautiful land being Israel. And so what this little horn does next is of vital interest to Daniel. Remember, Daniel is from Israel. He's plonked in Babylon at the moment, in exile, but his homeland is Israel. So he's got a vested interest. Probably been many a time when he's been thinking about how good it's going to be to get back to Israel, to our promised land. So the little horn starts small, but his impact on God's people is quite huge. Have a look at verse 10. It grew, the little horn grew, until it reached the host of the heavens, and it threw some of the starry host down to the earth and trampled on them. It set itself up to be as great as the prince of the host. It took away the daily sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was brought low. Because of rebellion, the host, that is the host of the saints, and the daily sacrifice were given over to it. It prospered in everything it did, and truth was thrown to the ground. So the dream's describing what's going to be some very dark days in the history of Israel. 400 years after Daniel, one of the ancestors of Seleucus, so he was one of the generals, he took the area of the Middle East, basically, Syria, which included Israel. One of Seleucus's ancestors was a bloke called Antiochus, and he was given the nickname Epiphanes. So he's referred to as Antiochus Epiphanes. He's actually the fourth one of them. You'll see him written up as Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. Anyway, Antiochus Epiphanes, he rose to power in 175 BC, and he did that on the back of imprisoning people, of being deceitful, of assassinating people that were in his way, doing political deals with the Romans, and even killing his younger brother who got in his way from ascending to the crown. Now, his nickname, Epiphanes, means God made manifest. He portrayed this image that he was God himself. And that's how he marketed himself. And in fact, that's actually what it says on his coin, which is on the picture there. So you could say that he had a very healthy ego. You'd say he was pretty deluded too. The fact of the matter is, and history attests to this, he was very brutal in his treatment of the Jews. He murdered many of them. He plundered the temple. He outlawed circumcision. He outlawed temple sacrifices. And he outlawed anyone possessing the scriptures, which for us would mean the Old Testament. And any scriptures he could get his hands on were burnt, torn up, destroyed, whatever. But that wasn't the end of it. He also erected a statue of the Greek god Zeus in the temple. And then he forced the Jews to worship that idol. And I guess on the basis that they wouldn't worship that idol, he murdered them. And then to really rub salt into the wound, he took an unclean animal, a pig in particular, unclean to the Jews that is, and sacrificed a pig on the temple altar in Jerusalem. That would be like us going to a barbecue with Jewish friends and cooking up pork chops for them. And the fact that he sacrificed this pig on the temple altar is probably what's meant in verse 13 by the rebellion that causes desolation. Well, that's pretty much the dream that Daniel had. That's the first 12 verses or so of the chapter. It was a dream about the future for Israel, and that paints a picture of some pretty dark days coming. And I'm sure Daniel would much rather not have dreamed about those days, but he has. One of the things that's amazing, we can say it's amazing because we, as I say, have the advantage of history and retrospect. And we can look back and see how the events that are described here play out exactly how Daniel dreamed them, which is why there's a whole bunch of liberal Bible scholars and others who would say it's so accurate. The book of Daniel must have been written after all these events happened. But the truth of the matter is, Daniel dreamed these things, a dream or vision given to him by God 400 years or so in advance of the events happening. So what was the point of Daniel dreaming this dream? Why did God give Daniel this vision? Why did God reveal all of this to him? Well, the first reason, I'm sure, was that it would show that God not only foresees these things coming in the future, but it's actually his hand that's all over these things that happen in the future. God brings these things about. Back up in Daniel's dream, in verse 13, the Holy One asks another Holy One, how long are these terrible events going to go on for? And he's referring to the vision concerning the daily sacrifice, the rebellion that causes desolation, and the surrender of the sanctuary and of the host that will be trampled underfoot. And the answer in verse 14 is 2,300 evenings and mornings. Exactly. Not an evening or morning less, and not an evening and morning later. 2,300 evenings and mornings. It's exact because this has come from God, and he knows. And he's bringing all these things to pass according to his time frame and his purposes. Yes, they're terrible events, but he knows the duration. He's set the duration for these things. It's all part of his perfect timing for his good purposes, and he will bring it to an end, and he will restore the sanctuary. Gabriel gives an explanation down in verse 25. Have a look at that with me. Gabriel says he will cause deceit to prosper, and he will consider himself superior, so this is in relation to the little horn. When they feel secure, he will destroy many and take his stand against the prince of princes. Yet he will be destroyed, but not by human power. So despite the unspeakable evil of what will happen, God's still got it all in control, and God will bring it all to a close. Now, that's pretty much the same point as all the other dreams we've seen in the book of Daniel. Every chapter you read in Daniel will draw you to the conclusion that God raises kings and kingdoms and takes kings and kingdoms down. It's God who puts a use-by date on all these kingdoms that he raises. God is sovereign in control over all kings, every king, all kingdoms, every kingdom. But the second thing we get from this is there's a pattern to the world. Again and again, kingdoms look permanent and indestructible. So in ancient days, it was Egypt and Assyria and Babylon and Media and Persia and Greece and Rome. They were the world's superpowers. How do they rate today as world superpowers? None of them are they? In our day and age, we look at the superpowers being the likes of America or Russia. We see China emerging. I wonder what history will tell us in 200 years from now as it looks back and talks about and reviews the rise and fall of kings and kingdoms. Will it be adding America and China to the list of Egypt and Assyria and Babylon? What we also see in this pattern of the world is that these kingdoms, these kings of these kingdoms, fight against God and fight against his people. So I want to say that we shouldn't be surprised on the basis of that or disappointed when it happens, because the reality is they always come to an end. You know, from Daniel's perspective, these visions he's having, these dreams, look ahead to a future ruler who'll stand against God and destroy the sanctuary. We've already seen one of such people of that nature, and that's Antiochus Epiphanes IV. He set up the rebellion that causes desolation. But he's just part of the pattern. A couple of hundred years later, when we get to the time of Jesus, Jesus also looks ahead to the future time, and he sees the same pattern repeating and talks about the same pattern repeating. And in fact, he borrows the language of Daniel when he's speaking to his disciples in Matthew chapter 24. You might want to flick over there with me. I'm just going to look at a few verses out of that passage that David read for us earlier. In verse 15, this is what Jesus says. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoke of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So you see, Jesus is using the language from Daniel. He says he's using the language from Daniel. And he's using that language to speak of another future proud and evil king who's yet to come. It's the same pattern. There's another one after Jesus who will come to be like Antiochus, a type of Antichrist, if you like. Perhaps at this point, with a shortish view, he had in mind someone like the Roman Emperor Caligula, who in the 1st century AD orders statues of Zeus to be set up in the Jerusalem temple. It's the pattern of the world. Leaders are anti-God, they are proud, they are also powerful. They arrogantly set themselves up against God. They put themselves in a position where they want to act like God, be God, and they make God's people suffer. It happened then, and it's happening today. But from this pattern, there's something that brings great hope. It's the hope that Daniel received too. It's the greatest comfort for God's people when they're suffering at the hands of powerful rulers or anybody who's seeking to persecute them. And the great comfort for the people of God is that there is someone else who actually has all the power. The power that the people of God are confronted with in this world is power that God is allowing them to have. But God is a much greater power, and in control of their power. And Daniel's already seen who it is that holds that power in chapter 7 of Daniel. The Son of Man. The Son of Man who's establishing his kingdom. A kingdom that is going to last forever. In chapter 7, verse 13, we saw the Son of Man coming on the clouds before God's throne and being given all authority and power by God. He'll sit on the heavenly throne, and all peoples and nations of every language will worship him. And this Son of Man, of course, is Jesus, who most often in the Gospel accounts refers to himself as the Son of Man, alluding back to Daniel chapter 7. The Son of Man, Jesus, God crowned him with glory and honour after his death and resurrection and ascension. And if we stay in Matthew's Gospel, we can read about Jesus looking forward to that event. In verse 15 and 16, we heard him speak about the suffering to come. Let me just read that again. So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoke of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. But then just a few verses further down in verse 30, this is what Jesus says. At that time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the nations of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. So there's dark days still ahead. But Jesus will put an end to all of them when he comes with glory and power. and he'll gather all those at that time who belong to him to himself. Everyone who suffered in evil kingdoms, people from every age and every place around the world. And that's indeed a wonderful hope to look forward to. It gives perspective for us when we're in the middle of the sort of suffering that's being described. And it should strengthen our resolve to persevere, to stick it out, to have our eyes fixed on the goal, the prize, the finish line. Whether our persecution is life-threatening, like our brothers in North Korea or Egypt or Syria, who endure physical and mental suffering, even death, or more likely for us, it's just the insults and shame and mockery of friends and family and workmates who disown us, who snigger and roll their eyes, who go quiet when we walk into a room, who tell us to keep our stupid beliefs to ourselves. You see, we're not alone. We're not unique. This has been going on for all time. It's a pattern. One of Jesus' disciples, Peter, wrote two letters, at least two letters that we have in the New Testament. And he wrote in his first letter to people who were experiencing the very same sorts of persecutions Jesus was looking ahead to. And Peter, in writing, had these words of comfort and perspective to say to the Christians. So this is 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 12. He says, "Dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering, as though something strange were happening to you, but rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ, so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed." You see, that's a perspective we're able to have this side of the cross, that Jesus' glory will one day be revealed and all his people vindicated. But Daniel didn't have that. And the events he'd seen were so terrible, it knocked him for a six. But even so, there's a little hint at the end of the chapter about how we can learn from Daniel's experience. It's right there in the last verse. So back to Daniel 8, verse 27. He starts by what I mentioned at the beginning. "I, Daniel, was exhausted and lay ill for several days. Then I got up and went about the king's business." You see, he processed all that he'd seen or been given to see. Undoubtedly, he prayerfully worked through all that he'd been given to see. And then he got up and went about the king's business. He got on with living faithfully in God's world for his glory. And we have a much greater king, don't we, whose business we are to be getting on with. Indeed, there are dark days ahead, no doubt. But here's the thing. We're not to get depressed about it. We shouldn't be paralyzed into fearful indecision because of it, or withdraw into holy huddles because of it. What we're to do is to get about doing the king's business. We're to get out into the world that belongs to the King of Kings and declare that his son Jesus has won the victory. And he's bringing it to bear. So that's advice that Peter gave to the persecuted Christians who were reading this particular letter in Asia Minor. His message was to get on with the King of Kings' business. A bit further on from that verse we just read, he says in chapter 5, verse 7, "Cast all your anxiety on him because he cares for you. Be self-controlled and alert. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, looking for someone to devour. Resist him, standing firm in the faith, because you know that your brothers throughout the world are undergoing the same kind of sufferings. And the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself restore you and make you strong, firm, and steadfast. To him be the power forever and ever. Amen." So the message is to be about the king's business, to be living as salt and light in a tasteless and dark world, to live out the truth. Despite how it may feel and how it may seem, as Christians we are not alone, we're not unique, We're just part of the pattern that God put in place for his world. It's a pattern that God is controlling and has control over. It's the pattern that God will one day draw a line under and bring it to an end. And that day is when his Son, the heavenly exalted Son of Man from Daniel 7, is revealed to everyone in all his glory and power. I'll just close with Jesus' words again from Matthew 24, verse 30. At that time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the nations of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the others. Let's pray.